Welcome to the Best of MBS podcast, a collection of the best interviews hosted by Michael Bungay Stanier, best-selling author of The Coaching Habit and How to Begin. Today's interview is from the Find Your Great Work interview series. Here's your host, MBS.
So if I was to tell you that we're about to have a conversation with a woman whose website has been called, and I kid you not, the best place online for kick-ass spirituality, would you be as excited as I am? Of course you would. And the thing is, that's actually not even hyperbole. That is actually pretty much the deal, that Daniel Laporte at daniellaporte.com has this ability to kind of reach. It's like finger painting. It's like spiritual finger painting. So he reaches and gets colors all over her hands and kind of wipes it all over the place and you go, pow. And why we're talking with Danielle is she has just about to release her new book, The Firestarter Sessions. Now, one of the cool things about my role is I occasionally get kind of early glimpses and early sneak reads of these new books coming out, as I have with Danielle's book, and it is fantastic. It's like 16 separate sessions, each one basically a permission slip to step up, be yourself, be authentic, strive for, you know, my language, strive for great work, and live a damn good life, a good life in terms of who you are and what shows up in your life and what's enough in your life and what impact you have in your life. So you can tell I'm just babbling a bit. I'm excited to be talking to Danielle. I'm going to get into some of the details of her book and the work that she does online. So Danielle, welcome to the call.
Oh, I'm so excited. Anybody who uses hyperbole in an introduction is I'm stoked already.
Well, the nice thing about that is I've only just found out how to pronounce it, because I always thought it was hyperbole, but in fact, it's hyperbole, two different words. Cool. So look, what haven't I told people about you so people have a sense of how you got to be the person you are? Where have you come from? What are you about?
What can I say about that? I am really interested in how conscious commerce and being vigilante consumers affects everything. I'm really interested in how the divine feminine affects specifically business. I'm interested in helping people become freer, just liberated, just real, you know, write your bio in first person, just come as you are. I'm interested in being of service. I love money. I love solitude. And I feel really alive when I write.
Wow. Great, great, great non-traditional introduction. That's fantastic, Danielle. So this is a wonderful book. You know, it's divided into three different parts. You've got Mojo Part 1, Moxie Part 2, and Results Part 3. And let's just talk a little bit about Mojo. You know, you say at the start of the book, being your true self is the most effective formula for success there is. And I guess my question is, why is that so hard? Why is it so hard to be your true self?
We're not trained, we're not conditioned to be sincere, to be genuine. The whole education system is set up, at least most of it, is set up for a right answer and a wrong answer. It's all about fitting in. I think from infancy, we are talked out of how we feel. I mean, I remember I was taking my son was very young, just a baby. We're going to one of those mommy and taught swim thing, which I hated. I hate swimming. That's not, I could put that in my introduction. And I saw a father who probably had great intentions. His little girl was crying and he said, "You're fine. You're okay." And she wasn't fine. She wasn't okay. And I thought, that's where it begins.
Right.
It just starts. It's so immediate. We get talked out of our feelings. And it's like, no, I'm cold, I'm scared, I'm hungry, I'm angry, whatever it is. So it starts with parenting. And then it works its way up to corporate policy.
You're right.
Military. That's inescapable. And we just don't get rewarded for getting out of the box, do we? You know?
Well, see, I was going to ask you, if we get talked out of it from an early age, and I think that's a nice way of putting it, how do we talk ourselves back into it? I mean, it's a journey for all of us, but, you know, what's worked for you in terms of your journey to kind of connect to the person that you are and how you want to show up in the world?
Well, I got really clear on what didn't work for me. So I, you know, like suffering is great for the sake of comparison. So, you know, one significant part of my vocational journey was I ran a think tank in Washington, D.C.
Right.
I had a group of futurists who, you know, we consulted to the Pentagon on the dynamics of social change. And, you know, the backstory there for me was really inside. I had this intense imposter complex. I was wearing black suits and loafers, you know, and it's like, you could see me now.
Right.
Lots of tattoos. And it's all about, you know, the higher the heel, the better. But I felt like a fake. I felt like I was going to be found out. And the more kind of closed conversations I had with people about that feeling, the more people would step forward and say, I feel like I'm going to get caught all the time at wanting something else, at wanting more. At being unhappy, at thinking these policies are ridiculous. But so I knew where my pain points were.
Right.
Another, you know, sort of significant, I left DC, I started this lifestyle media company, I wrote a book, Oprah called, it was all based on like soulful style. And we raised lots of money and lots of people came on board to help sort of, you know, make us the new it girls. And the more people who came into that and the more money I came to the table, the more quiet I got. And it ended up being excruciating for me. So, you know, I got canned from my own incorporation.
Right.
Some karma came around and it all folded for the rest of them 3 months later. But the extremely, extremely, you know, bring me to my knees situations. And in both of them, I just found like immediate gratitude, an immediate sense yes, finally, and just became really clear. Do not want to live my life that way. And once you get clear that something sucks, I call this like, you know, the revelation of suckage.
Right. Exactly.
Then the change will come. I think what happens to so many people is we're afraid to even admit how painful things are, how uncomfortable, how unsatisfying they are. Because we don't have a solution yet. And my answer to that is, don't worry about the solution. Don't worry about how you're going to get out of it. Just like fully be in the suck factor.
Right.
And then the solution emerges. But like, you will not get clear if you're in denial.
You know, it's great. You know, one of my favorite writers, the person who's probably the most influential in general as a writer for me, is a guy called Peter Block. He writes about business. And he has a wonderful book called The Answer to How is Yes. And I think it speaks to the paralyzing effect of going, even if I've noticed something's wrong, if I don't have a solution to it, then I'll pretend it's not wrong or I'll just try and endure it until I find that solution. And I love your insight, which is actually stepping fully into the suckiness of it, the messiness of it, is often that the process that leads to the insight of liberation, of how do I get out of this?
Mm-hmm. And in that stepping into it, you have to be really vulnerable because you're not showing up with an answer for yourself or anybody around you. You know, and this works in relationships, and this works in leadership scenarios. And so you're vulnerable, and at the same time you're courageous. It's just like I'm getting real and becoming lucid, and that's like completely liberating. I highly recommend it.
Do you think you have to, does everybody run into walls? I mean, you talk about the think tank and then about the kind of cool media company and basically being kind of finding yourself, actually, this isn't a pathway so much as a dead end. And I think back in my own career, I'm like, God, I've got stories that parallel that where I go, you know, lots of external metrics that seem to be good, but actually an internal metric of this is a bit of a disaster.
Yeah.
Is that just part of the journey? Does everybody go through that, or is there an easier way?
This is such an interesting territory, because I think the thought form that you have to suffer to grow,
yeah,
is a bit ridiculous actually. Mm. So I think you can grow without trauma. I think the more self-aware you become,
yeah,
and the more aware you become of the small things in your everyday existence that aren't working for you, so the more aware you are of the small stuff, of the subtleties, the less drama and trauma and severity you're going to bring into your life in terms of life lessons. It's like, you know, just require nudges to stay awake and on track instead of 2x4s. So it's the subtlety is of, does this work for me in a meeting? You know, do I like how this feels? Is this what I want to bring into my home? Is this what I want to buy today? Is this what I want to eat? Did I like how I said that?
Right.
Very subtle.
Yeah.
But those are the tiny, the micro experiences of contrast where you're constantly saying, that worked, that didn't. Mm. You know, creativity is all about this works, this doesn't.
Right.
It's like you're constantly choosing. And I just, you know, really, if I'm on a pulpit for anything, it's about make more choices. Choose everything every day. Choose how you're going to wake up. Choose what you're going to say no to. All the free shit you get offered all day. It's not really free. Say no. Choose your thoughts. Choose your food. Choose your friends.
Yeah, it's a lovely metaphor. I mean, where I go with it is this a parallel metaphor of, like, if you're sailing a boat, it's like the subtle nudges on the tiller that keep you sailing true. It's not the big tack that makes the difference. It's actually reading the wind and adjusting to where you are in the moment. That's what actually helps you sail most cleanly, I don't sail, so I don't... This metaphor may not work at all. I don't sail. What am I talking about? But if I did sail, this metaphor would be awesome.
It sounds so adventurous. You're sounding so Sebastian Younger right now.
Exactly right.
I think it's a great metaphor because reading the wind requires like full tilt awareness. Like, I mean, really, this is about wide awake living, you know?
Yeah, yeah. So one of the chapters, and I think it connects to what we're talking about, one of the sessions of the 16 sessions you have in the book is entitled Fear and Other Tough Stuff. And, you know, there are times when we're bumping into the external reality of going, God, this is not the job for me. I'm wearing a black suit and loafers and all that sort of stuff. But often what we're running into is less about an external context and more about our own anxiety, our own fears. Is there a process for avoiding fear? You know, this whole, I don't have to suffer to progress, or is there something valuable about stepping into fear and managing it in a different way?
And then I think trying to avoid fear is intensely detrimental. Mm. I think you trying to avoid fear is like trying to avoid curiosity. Just think about it. Right. You can't avoid being curious about something. You are or you aren't. So I think you shouldn't avoid it. You should actually look for it. Every new situation, you think, what am I scared of? You're scared of something. Mm-hmm. And it's a huge teacher. I love my fears.
Right.
But I'm really clear that I lead my fears. They do not manage me. They have a very particular seat on the bus. So, you know, I listen to them, I thank them, and then they stay in their place. They do not run the show. But, you know, it's like, you know, Kierkegaard said that your anxiety is a tool for liberation.
Doesn't he say it's the dizziness of freedom?
Oh, that's so good. Yes, so good. So there's some kind of clue in your fear. And once you can, like, figure it out, then you can figure out, I don't know if combat is the right word, but how you're going to integrate it. But you can't avoid it.
What I love what you're pointing to is this, and you said it yourself, this whole concept of and importance of how do I keep being conscious of the choices ahead of me and how do I keep making the best possible choice for me in that space? And, you know, I think you're pointing to two big choices immediately. One is, what do I want? And, you know, the flip side of that is, what don't I want? But what do I want is such a powerful question. And this other one, which is, what am I afraid of? And sort of connected to that, where's my courage? I think are two such powerful ways of navigating through life by asking just those two questions time and time and time again.
Mm-hmm. There's another layer to the what do I want question for me, which is, how do I want to feel? And I think that's potentially revolutionary for people's lives. It's because what I see happen is that I think we have our relationship to ambition is completely upside down, at least in Western culture. So we say, I want that job. I want that salary. I want that relationship. I want the boat, the babe, whatever. Mm-hmm. And those are all external things. And those are all great things, like great things. But those desires are driven by an internal desire to feel a certain way. So I think if you first got clear on how you want to feel, then your business plan and your to-do list and your goal setting should be based on generating those particular feelings. Because you might discover that if you want to feel connected or innovative or creative, you don't need the boat or the babe or the salary. You might find out, you know, you need simplicity, or, you know, you need $6 million instead of $2 million. Who knows?
Right.
You can never guarantee that you're going to love what you want when you get it, right? When you reach the goal, but I think having your goals based on your core desired feelings really increases the odds of enjoying what you get when you get it.
Or in a similar way, having those goals evolve as they kind of reflect, actually, this is how I'm feeling, and this is a shift in context. So this is the way the goal shifts to reflect that change in context, even if the feeling remains the same.
Yes.
So let me take you to the results section, because you got, six or seven of your maps in your sessions in this final section of the book. And when I was reading through it, I have to say, these are the ones where I kind of did the most underlining and the most asterisking. And perhaps because I think you're preaching to the choir here. I'm like, yes, I agree with everything Daniel's saying. And one of them is around make stuff that feels good to make. And what I want you to talk to me about is, why is it important to make stuff?
Well, the first word that comes to my mind is like to exist. We're creative people, beings, everybody, whether you're making a family, you know, how you run your household, or you're making a meeting agenda. This is you out in the world. And I used to resist the whole concept of, you know, it's the journey, it's the process is as important as the production. I used to just, not be into that at all. I was like, no, it's all about the results. And I've changed. I've matured. I have learned that the more fun I have making something, the better it turns out. And like, hey, the more fun I have. I mean, it really just gets down to, I just want to have a good time doing it. And it's just become particularly clear to me in the last couple of years. The more I like the people that I work with, the better the product turns out. And when I say it just sounds so like banal and oversimplified, but I just don't want to work with people who I don't want to party with,
right?
Who I'm going to at least, you know, spend 2 days of my vacation with. I mean, my metric now for like collaboration is, would I have you over to my home for dinner? Like, I don't cook, so I got to really love you. If I cook for you,
right,
should probably write a book together, you know?
Right. Well, let's talk about that, because what I love is how you move from the making piece, which I think is really important. It's that sense of, what am I bringing into the world? And there's something about recognizing that you're making stuff means that you kind of have to go, if this is what I'm making, then make something that I can be proud of. And if you can be proud of it, then we're going to have a bit less of the BS and the crap and the mediocrity that I think fills up a lot of space, and a little bit more around that kind of the pride of an artisan or a craftsman. I mean, if you went into it going, look, what if I built my meetings like a craftsman would build her meetings? What would that look like? Then we start getting, I think, into an interesting conversation. But you took us in the route of collaboration, and that's kind of cool for me. 2012, for me, my big theme is deep collaboration. That's kind of what I want to immerse myself in, explore. And so I'm curious to know, you know, you've shared one secret of collaboration, which is, if you're not prepared to break bread with them, don't collaborate with them. But how do you even find the right people to collaborate with? How do you even bump into them in the first place so you can invite them back to your place?
Well, I'm attracted to people who are generous. So I think I have my some of my behaviors that I prefer in people. Yeah. And I think you can find everyone anywhere, really. but you have to have your prerequisites. So my prerequisites are I only work with people who believe that everything happens for a reason. I mean, this sounds very, you know, this sounds as righteous as, like, you know, just fundamentalist, but, you know, I used to think, this has been part of my evolution. I used to think that in order to be a robust entrepreneur or spiritually developed human, that I needed to have, like, diversity all around me in terms of my work world.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would work with people who saw the world very differently than I did. And it just never worked out. There was always, someone got pissed off. There were legal things involved.
Right.
And when I just thought, fire get that. I need to work with people who have the same worldview from as me. Right. So that worldview is basically everything happens for a reason. It's all progress. And that, you know, trust is a form of strength. Mm. Once you're there, then, like, let's party. It doesn't matter to me if you're a Buddhist, Baptist, fundamentalist, Republican. Then it becomes about diversity. Then I work with people who are finishers, because, you know, I'm a starter. I finish because I'm a grown up, but, you know, people who are detail oriented.
Yes.
So it's like worldview. I have the same worldview and generous. And I, you can tell those people are, you know, the people you want to collaborate with, I would say across the board, this is sort of in the zone of advice, are,
yes,
they're generous with their wisdom. They're scrupulous with their time and they respect themselves.
That's really,
and if I'm going on, they're going to respect you. They're going to be generous with you. Yeah. They're going to have healthy boundaries.
Yeah, I love that. You know, I'm just thinking, how do I figure out who I would love to collaborate with? And in part, it's a connection. I agree with you. I would use different language from a similar worldview, but for me, I would go, you need to make me think and you need to make me laugh. Mm-hmm. You need to make me think because I actually want you to have a different perspective than I am on some stuff. But you need to make me laugh because we need to share a sort of fundamental understanding about how the world works and what's absurd about it. Mm-hmm. And so for me, that thinking and laughing piece is both the foundation of connection and the value of diversity is part of that as well. Mm-hmm. But I love that other piece around generosity around that as well. It's one of the chapters in your book around being generous as a theme. And I think mm-hmm. that piece around finding the people that have that heart can be a very powerful, wonderful group of people to work with.
Mm-hmm. I'm gonna do a Patreon book. I'm adding make me think and make me laugh to your record.
Nice. We're converging in a perfect way, which is entirely the appropriate place to do that because we're getting to the very end of the call, even though we barely scratched the surface of the Firestarter sessions. I know people, many people know you already, but there's bound to be a few people who haven't bumped into you. So for those people that they can bump into you, how do they find you on the web, on Twitter, wherever? Where would you point them to?
Online, it's daniellelaporte.com, formerly known as whitehottruths.com, but I'm just completely cut out. No more brand. I am me.
Right.
And I'm on Facebook. I got a fan page there. And on Twitter, I'm at Danielle Laporte.
Fantastic.
And Starter Sessions is everywhere. So Amazon, Powell's, et cetera, comes out on April 17th.
Fantastic. Is there a separate website for the book or is it all under daniellelaporte.com?
You can get there through the umbrella of Danielle Laporte. But if you just instinctively want to go to thefirestartersessions.com, of course it will lead you to the book. And there's going to be lots of goodies around that, a campfire guide, group reading stuff. I'm starting a whole project called What Lights Your Fire and asking people to let me know what lights their fire, either, you know, in text or video or postcard.
Yeah.
It's going to get hot around here. Yeah.
That's awesome. Danielle, it's always a pleasure to bump into you, to talk to you, to have you share your wisdom. So thank you so much for your time.
Oh, brilliant. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this Best of MBS interview. Want more great content? Head to mbs.works. There you'll find MBS's new podcast, Two Pages. You can learn about his best-selling books, and you can join the newsletter. That's mbs.works.